Hi there, and welcome to the first episode of our brand new podcast, The Wagon, with me, Finty Williams, and the brilliant psychotherapist and my friend, John McEwan. Before we start, we want to say thank you to Ibiza Calm, who has made this entire series possible. Ibiza Calm is a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health, and we are eternally grateful to them. In this series, we are aiming, with the help of some amazing guests, to shed light on addiction and of the helplessness of addiction and the shame that comes with saying, I'm an addict. So to kick off, we just wanted to say that everyone who speaks on this podcast has either suffered from an addiction or has had a family member affected by it, or they have been instrumental in helping people recover. And John and I are so massively grateful to each and every one of them for being willing and brave enough to share their stories.
But before we start talking to our wonderful guests, we figured that we should introduce ourselves so that you know who we are and why we felt so passionate about putting this series together. It means a lot to us both professionally in my case and personally for me, and also for Fint, obviously. And I think Finty's going to introduce me.
I am.
Great.
It gives me the most pleasure in the world to introduce my co-host, John McEwan. Without his help and patience, I almost certainly wouldn't be sitting here today. We first met quite a while ago. Our therapeutic relationship lasted for about 12 years.
Yep.
And since that therapy has finished, John is the person that I contact and whose advice I seek when I have a friend who's in need of some advice or somebody who I think needs to see a counsellor. And he's always been there for them. So I thank you for that.
Thank you. There's quite a lot of them as well. There's been quite a lot over the years.
There have.
Yeah.
So, John, bizarrely, I didn't realise until a couple of days ago that I actually didn't know that much about you.
Mm.
Because, of course, we had a therapeutic relationship.
Yeah.
I didn't know that much about you. So for me and for everybody listening, will you explain how you got to where you are and what led you there?
Yeah. No, well, it's a mixture here of excitement and nerves because, as you know, and what we're going to talk about a lot is the whole therapeutic journey of people stopping and trying to stay stopped from alcoholism and or other addictions. So my story, and I'm going to quote Paul O'Grady here, actually, believe it or not, I'm from a little fishing village in Merseyside, which, otherwise known as Birkenhead. And it was a rather kind of crazy area that I grew up in. But it was one of those sort of new build estates, you know, the sort of 60s, early 60s, there was a kind of rebuild of lots of areas, and we had a lovely house and there was lots of green grass around. But of course, what happened, you know, a lot of the kind of smaller communities, a lot of the working class communities were moved on to this lovely place. You know, my story is, and this is where it really stemmed from, is we were surrounded by kind of, you know, Scottish, Irish, Scouse, you name it, kind of working class people who all loved to drink. And there were more pubs in our area than certainly than churches. You know, the community really centred around the pub. They met in the pub. They had fights in the pub.
Because that's what everybody did at the time.
Yeah, it really was. And you know, I won't go on about the working class thing too much, but, you know, it was that kind of culture. You'd finish work, you go to the pub.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you didn't have a job, you'd go to the pub. So, you know, so much of it centred around it. So, and if you weren't in the pub and you went to someone's house, there was alcohol. You know, someone would be drinking. So it was normal to kind of grow up in a culture where you thought, okay, well, that's what we do, we drink.
Mm.
And of course, inappropriately, adults would give us drinks, you know, so that they could usually laugh at us when we sort of dancing around or whatever. But I realised that I liked this thing called alcohol. And I started to rely on it. And I'm talking when I was like kind of really young. So I started smoking when I was in primary school.
No.
I mean, the idea of my daughter, who's still in primary school, about to finish smoking cigarettes, it's unbelievable.
It's mind-boggling.
But I did. And not only that, the dinner lady, who I was going to name but I won't, used to give me cigarettes. You know, and again, that was the culture. You were kind of almost doing someone a favour. So I was quite addictive. You know, I smoked. I drank when I could. And then, and I'm talking 10, 11, 12. And then where I lived, again, it was fairly normal for the older boys and girls, I guess, to smoke marijuana, to smoke weed. So I kind of progressed onto that because that's what you did. You'd be around the pub and someone would light a spliff and go, oh, yeah, do you want some of this? And then we ended up, you know, going into people's houses and we'd all kind of chip in. Pocket money, actually, believe it or not. You know, and back then the portions were quite generous. You know, you'd get a matchbox full of hash for you know, 150 or whatever it was. And there was lots of it around. So, you know, that was, again, part of how I grew up. It didn't seem to affect my schooling too much initially. But then, of course, eventually it did because I was smoking more, I was drinking more. Then someone said, have you ever tried magic mushrooms? So, being open-minded and having this addictive personality, I tried that. And basically, you know, quite quickly I was trying whatever was around, you know. Do you want one of these? Yeah, I'll have two, thanks. You know, and it's not until obviously I got sort of into my sort of recovery that I look back and think, God, I was just like, I had an appetite for getting off my head.
And were there a lot of people around you doing the same thing? Was it not an uncommon thing to be doing?
Very common. It's a very important point to make that. It wasn't like I was kind of sneaking off somewhere on my own or, you know, I had to kind of travel miles to the sort of centre of Liverpool or somewhere to get, you know, it was just everywhere. And it seemed like everybody did it, you know, and it was true. A lot of my peers did. And, you know, probably that 16, 17, 18 year, when I was 18 years old, period was probably quite severe. There was a lot of class A drugs came into play. There was opiates around, there was cocaine. And there was a sort of, you know, there was always a little something around to try. I was using drinking drugs every day and I was struggling.
And how old were you at this point?
I was 19, 20. And I'd lost a lot of weight and I wasn't functioning very well and my family was worried about me and I was getting a bit of negative attention from people, including the police. I thought something has to change. But of course, when you look at what was available, there weren't a lot of options. So for me, what happened, there was a guy who was like a counsellor, and I know we're going to touch on this in a later episode, who was one of the significant people in my life who could just see, hang on, this kid's struggling, you know, this kid needs help and I'm going to try and help him. And he helped me move to London to a project, which is like a kind of recovery house, sort of hostel. But I moved to London and, you know, that was quite an adventure, but it was my chance to get away. And fortunately, one, I was ready and two, I had a bed, you know, I had somewhere safe to live. And I had an amazing team that worked there who believed in me. And there were other people, there were eight other people who lived in there. And we all helped each other out. And, you know, then I started going to self-help groups, which I want to mention because I still do. They've really helped me over the years. And whilst I was at that hostel in Tooting Beck, a lovely woman called Debbie, who was managing it, after I'd been there about 9 months, and because I love football, I'd organised different football matches with different houses. So I'd organised these competitions. And she said to me, I think you might be good working with people. And I was a bit embarrassed. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I've seen you. You know, you're quite good with people. You organise things. And she said, why don't you come into this field, the field of work?
That's extraordinary. After 9 months. Wow.
Yeah. And I was due to move out in 2 months, got myself a flat. True to her word, she gave me a job. So I went back to work where I lived, which was a weird transition for a while. And they paid for a counselling course. And it's worth throwing this in because I don't want to be a snob. I was a scaffolder. I didn't mention that bit. I trained as a scaffolder. So I, you know, that was kind of what I did to earn some money. I never really liked it, but it was fun and you kept fit. And it was winter, and that was another agenda. I thought, I can get off building sites here, you know, into one of those soft chairs. And I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest, Vince. Someone paid, you know, me. It wasn't just a compliment. They believed in me. And I thought, well, why not? And, you know, a long story short, I got qualified. I went off to work for a rehab for that same charity. Mm. And then I went off to a great place called Clouds House, which I'm sure we'll mention over the time. That's a very professional addiction unit in Wiltshire. And I spent a year there and I loved it. I loved living there. And again, I trained, you know, I became professional. So it wasn't just about being an ex-drinker or an ex-drug taker. It was, you know, game on here. You're a professional now. You've got to learn to have boundaries and you've got to learn to listen and you've got to learn. And that was amazing for me because it's where I sort of grew up as well. I was about 25, 26 at this stage. So not long after that, a few years later, I became a kind of fully qualified therapist. From there, I ended up working in different institutions. I'm proud to say I worked with what's now called the Forward Trust. It used to be called RAPT, which was Rehabilitation for Addicted Prisoners Trust. And I was one of the first counsellors in there. In fact, there were only two of us. And we set up six addiction units in six different prisons. And, you know, over 6 years. And that's when I really grew because, you know, if you go into that environment as a professional, you have to kind of have your wits about you and stuff. And I loved it. And there were people like Anthony Hopkins was funding it and Eric Clapton, and they came into the unit. And so, you know, they were amazing because they gave us some really important funding. So,
and this has now grown to...
Well, I spoke to the chief executive the other day, and apparently the charity turns over £400 million.
So and the amount of people it must help.
The amount of prisoners.
The amount of people who end up in prison because of their addiction.
Yeah. What is it, 85% of the prison population, male and female? I think the female population is higher in terms of addiction and or depression as a causal effect for offending. So, you know, you've got to treat addiction. If you don't treat addiction, what are people going to do? They're going to come out and they're going to do the same old stuff.
Absolutely.
And I think we'll touch on that, won't we, later on in other podcasts.
Yeah.
So I ended up working at the Priory. I worked in lots of other different places. And then a friend of mine said to me, why don't you get something going on Ibiza? There was nothing, no help. You know, people chuckle when you say that about Ibiza because of the kind of hedonism and stuff. And a very long story short, we ended up opening Ibiza Calm, which is a residential treatment program for addictions and mental health issues. It's a 10-bed unit. I'm not going to give it too much of a plug, but it's a very good place to go if you need it. And my role there now is actually chief executive, so I've gone through the ranks. I still, as you know, practice as a therapist as well. So it's interesting that this whole parallel thing between my recovery and my career has been very kind of, you know, in tandem. Mm. I know you're going to say the same at some stage, but it's the best thing I ever did. You know, I didn't know that asking for help, even though that was difficult at the time, putting my hands up and saying, you know what, I'm not functioning very well here. I'm struggling. And that there were one or two people there who said, okay, come on, we'll try and help you. And if it wasn't for them, I seriously wouldn't be here. I know that for sure. Because some of my friends aren't. You know, we've lost a lot of friends over the way.
Yeah. It's extraordinary that you found yourself in a place, and from that, you have been able to help so many other people because of having been in that place.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if you hadn't been there, maybe you would have taken a totally different career path. Yeah. But it's extraordinary.
So I'm really keen to hear a bit about you now. I know a bit more about you than you knew about
more.
Me. But...
Yes, I'm very different to you. I had an amazing childhood. I had an amazing upbringing. I had extremely successful parents who were incredibly good at what they did. And our house was always filled with very sparkly, wonderful people and a lot of parties and a lot of champagne. And or maybe it wasn't champagne back then. I don't remember. Because unlike you, I didn't drink at all. I can see now that I had a very addictive personality. I used to go and see shows and musicals, but I wouldn't go and see them once or twice. I'd go and see them 16, 17, 18 times. Wow. And now as I look back, I can see that that was, you know, something a little strange. I was not one of the cool kids at school. They were all the ones going off to sort of gatecrasher balls and all of those kind of things, and I was never allowed to go to those. But I was really happy. I left school at 17. That was great. Started working and then went to drama school. And I went to drama school on my 19th birthday. And within 10 minutes of walking in, I wanted to be almost anybody else than who I was. I hated what I looked like. I was frightened by the brilliance and the sparkliness of all the people around me. And I genuinely, for absolutely no reason, I felt like a fraud. I just didn't think I belonged there. And I remember just about getting through the first day and barely speaking to anyone. And I was wearing all black and I was sort of very sort of, I must have looked like a real idiot. But it was purely born out of this sudden, very overwhelming feeling of just not being good enough, which had come out of absolutely nowhere. And we went to the pub that evening and I had a couple of pints and I realised that I could be quite funny and lucid, and the fear went, which of course is a terrible thing for an addict to find out, because then an awful lot of my time was spent in the pub. I got through the whole of drama school, but, you know, I wasn't probably doing as well as I could. I certainly didn't look as good as I could. But I loved being in the pub. I just thought it was great. And then something happened to me when I was in the third year, which I'm not going to talk about because it now sounds totally irrelevant. But it hurt me very, very, very deeply. And I turned to a friend of mine and I said, I want to go out tonight and drink until I can't remember how much this hurts.
What age was that?
21.
Right, wow.
Just 21. In fact, the week after my 21st birthday. And that set a precedent for me in the fact that there was something that I found out that I could do that stopped the hurt or stopped. I always call it the shadow that's on my back that's telling me that I'm not good enough or talented enough or pretty enough or funny enough or entertaining enough or intelligent enough. That's a big one for me. I still have that a lot. And I just got completely overwhelmed by it. And then when I was 24, the best thing happened to me ever, which was when I had my son, who is honestly the light of my life, and I absolutely adore him. He's now 22, nearly. But I just didn't feel like I knew where I fitted into anything, because very much like you, a lot of my friends were, you know, they'd got university degrees and they were starting families and getting married, and I didn't have any of that. And for some reason, put a lot of emphasis on those things. I had this beautiful baby and I was should have been terribly happy. But I just didn't feel good enough in anything. And around this time, my mother became sort of very famous, which was a wonderful thing. I got to go to amazing, extraordinary things. But all the time, it just made me feel like I was becoming less relevant. And that's in no fault at all of her, or it might have been the fault of some of the people around her in certain circumstances, but it certainly was nothing to do with my mother, and I think she would have stopped it all immediately if she'd thought it was. Then when I was 27, my father died, and I always remember the day that he died. One of the first things that happened was somebody handed me a glass of wine. And that was how I dealt with the feeling that my world had come crashing down. And I couldn't understand how people got through it in a sober way, in a responsible way, in a dignified way, because I certainly didn't. And very soon after that, I was found myself in rehab for the first time. And I just wasn't ready to go. I still had so much anger about my father dying and the way that I'd behaved in the lead up to that. That actually, to be honest to those people in that rehab facility, it was almost impossible. Because I couldn't actually be honest with myself, because I was so frightened of facing the person that I was and facing up to some of the stuff that had happened. I really wish I had, because like we all know, when you come out of something like that and you relapse, then your addiction actually starts being as bad as it was when you stopped.
Yeah.
It doesn't start from the top again. You're right back into it. It's horrible. It's loathsome. It's so dark, so frightening. I remember looking in the mirror once and thinking, I don't actually know how I am going to get through the next day being me, because there was not a synapse in my body that I felt that I could trust or rely on or respect. I was still working. Very kind people were employing me, and for a while I sort of got through it. And then there was a particularly disastrous evening, which I actually still can't talk about the actual circumstances of.
It's understandable.
My toes curl up and I want to put the duvet over my head because I'm so ashamed of it.
Was it drink-related?
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
And the person who was employing me at the time was Bill Kenwright. And he phoned me the next day and said, "Fint, I have a friend of mine coming to see you tonight. And that's my friend John McEwen," which is when our paths crossed.
That's when we met.
And that evening, if you remember, it was a Sunday evening.
I remember it well.
And I cried and I protested and I was angry. But the overwhelming feeling, and I really want to stress this, particularly because I think that people see people who have addictions as being irresponsible, and that it's a choice, and that it's so many things that we impose upon ourselves. I was just so frightened about the thought of not drinking.
Yeah.
Not because I like the taste of alcohol, although tequila used to kind of, you know, make me fairly sparkly. But it was just for that fact that once you put that down, then you have to face up to the horror.
Yeah.
And the carnage and the hurt that you have caused people that in your right mind you would never, ever do. And that was the most terrifying thing in the world. Mm. So you took me up to the Priory, and that was the first time that that things started to make sense for me, and I did try and give into it a bit more. And there were amazing counsellors there. My significant counsellor was the amazing Errol, who we both know.
We miss Errol, yeah.
Who we miss terribly. He was an extraordinary man. And I came out, and that was good for 4 years. And then one day, not because something terrible had happened, not because something wonderful had happened, for no reason whatsoever, I went into a pub and I ordered a glass of wine. There was no rhyme or reason to it. I just did. And it was straight back into it again, but it was worse, and it was nasty, and it was messy, and it was scary. So my mother sent me back to the Priory, which was an extraordinary thing, because I was so pleased to be there, because I knew it was a safe place that could, if I tried hard enough, give me the answers.
Mm.
Or give me the help. But there was so much shame attached to having been back. I was like, I didn't do it. So strangely, that feeling of, oh my God, I'm not even good enough to do this, even though I now understand that it's not like that.
Mm.
But there was that feeling of such embarrassment that I was back there. And that time was extraordinary and wonderful. And I came out and I clung on for dear life. I still don't think, if I'm really honest, that I was doing it for myself. I think I was still trying to get sober for other people, which is never the best way to do it.
No.
So eventually, I ended up going to Cottonwood. Again, thanks to you. Cottonwood is in Arizona. It's in the middle of the desert in Arizona. And at the time, it was the first dual diagnosis centre in the world.
Yes, it was.
And that is...
Well, it's basically, it deals with a number of things, but often with alcoholism and other addictions, there's a secondary condition. Sometimes that's depression, bipolar disorder, occasionally a personality disorder. So it deals with the whole person. And I think what you found useful is the fact that they spend time talking about the past and other things related to what got us into that place in the first place. What got us in that state in the first place, whereas the old-style rehab was just more about kind of, you know, talking just solely about drinking and drug-taking and
the immediacy of it.
The immediacy of it.
Cottonwood was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. And I came out, and it changed my life. And I fought it for 3 days being there. And there was an amazing woman called Rami Katz there, and she said, please stay for 24 hours. And she must have known this, because it was very grey and cold and desolate, and there was a thunderstorm. And I woke up the next morning, and it was like that moment of The Wizard of Oz when it suddenly goes into colour. And it was just the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. I still get really emotional talking about it. But I came out, and... apart from a very small blip 8 years ago, where I was brave enough to reach out and ask for help, it's been good. My life has changed. My life is better than it has ever been. I'm at a stage in my career that I'm really proud of. I'm very open about saying that I'm an alcoholic.
How long did that take to get to that stage where you could, in the right situation with the right people, say, I'm an alcoholic or I don't drink because?
About 5 years ago, I started being brave enough to say it.
Right.
Maybe a bit before that, actually. Mm. Maybe sort of six or seven years ago. Because I just figured that if we're brave enough and we lay our cards on the table straight away, then you never get to that stage in the pub where they go, oh, just have one. Mm. Oh, go on, just, you know, or come to the pub and you just actually want to be at home watching Friends, you know, with a cup of tea and a hot water bottle. Mm. But the one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast was because I have come up against several occasions with the media where I've been interviewed about a certain subject and... all they seem interested in is the darkest, scariest, most irresponsible times in my life. And in America, they have a respect for people who are in recovery. And they recognize it as a disease that people have to work through.
Mm.
And here, it seems that you're never allowed to recover from that. And one particular interview I can think of affected me so much, I came home and said to my boyfriend, I can't do this anymore. I'm not willing to...
Well, you nearly gave up acting.
Yeah. That was last October.
Recent?
Yeah. Because I said, I can't... there is nothing in my life that is greater... than the person who I am today. Not in a selfish way, but as a mother, as a daughter, as a girlfriend, as a friend. Mm. You know, I'm proud of the fact that people think that I'm a responsible human being. And for somebody to come along who 3 days later will have forgotten the fact that they even wrote an interview, throwing accusations at somebody, if I hadn't had the people around me over those 3 days... who knows? I don't know whether I'd have gone out and had a drink or whether... And that's not right. But it's all to do with the fact that still in this country, we have this shame about the fact that we have a disease, that we suffer from a disease, that whether it takes the form of alcohol or drugs or gambling or, I don't know, playing an Xbox too much.
Yeah, or shopping.
Shopping or... That has to be something that is addressed, and it has to be something that's taken seriously for what it is. And that's why I am so pleased that we're here and that we're doing this.
Yeah.
Because if we can make one person feel a little less ashamed of asking for help, then happy days.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, that's amazing. I knew a fair bit of that, but there was elements I didn't know, and particularly sadly, that part where, you know, you're being written about publicly and you know, it's not easy to kind of, despite what we know, it's a condition, it's an illness. You know, lots of people have it.
Mm.
And yet still, as you say, in our culture, it's not okay to admit it. It's not okay to talk about it. More and more people, fortunately now, Prince William, it's coming out talking about mental health. It's incredible. So, but we've got a long way to go, haven't we? And hopefully during this next,
But very importantly, what you've just said, mental health, it comes under that banner.
It does.
It really does. It's not a separate thing.
No, well said. It's not, you know, it's not some sort of moral deficiency or weakness, addiction, and its very forms, many forms. It's under the mental health banner.
Yeah.
And, as you said earlier, we're going to be getting into that conversation much more deeply about what we do to overcome it. How can we help each other?
And how do you, on a daily, weekly basis, how do you maintain that?
One of the things I did, and I didn't really know I was doing it, is I established some good friends around me.
Mm. And that so was, important.
I mean, gosh. And that was via the self-help groups that I was attending, and also just in my life, in my work too, because I work in this world, so it's, you know, I'm constantly reminded of the dangers of complacency and relapse. And, you know, I've said to you a lot of times, I've been to too many funerals already, you know, and but that's where it takes a lot of people if they can't get the right help. So what do? I keep fit. I go to therapy. I try and grass myself up, which is a term that I never used to like, but it's about saying I need to share what's going on in my mind, because if I don't, I might act on it. And as we know, that's where sometimes the cravings can start, you know, just a little thought. It's a summer's day. Look at that. I haven't drank for years. Just a few, just a little one, just a bit of this. So, you know, I've got to be on my game, and I that's part of my condition. So I'm lucky enough to have a support group, because if I'm going off track, and of course my wife does this sometimes, is, you know, I get the tap on the shoulder and someone might say, do you want to go to a meeting?
Hmm.
Or do you need to share something? Because they see it before me.
Yes.
So I've got support around me. I check in with therapy. I go to a group support still. I try and look after myself physically. And I enjoy my life. I mean, I'm fortunate. You know, I'm not one of these people who sobered up and feel sorry for themselves. I love it. You know, I travel the world. I mean, I've done lots of things, you know, because I was free and I was able to do that.
Hmm.
And what about you? How do you look after yourself?
To start with, I think that however anybody gets through it, great.
Yes,
I have no judgment at all on whether people, you know, have therapy, whatever they do to get themselves through it. When I was in rehab, I heard somebody say living life on life's terms, and that made so much sense to me. And of course, I speak to you. I know that channel of communication is always open.
Yeah.
But I just try and take life on. I have amazing friends. And the bizarre thing that I do with my son a lot of the time, I never used to go to rock concerts. Music, very, very, very loud music for me now is a form of therapy. And I love it. I absolutely love it. Mm. And that rejuvenates me. But, you know, there's always the downside to not drinking. I had to go to a wedding the other week and I knew the groom and my boyfriend and that was it. And he couldn't understand why I didn't want to dance. That is the most terrifying thing in the world, to have to get up at a wedding.
I bet you're a good dancer.
It doesn't really matter about ability. It was the fear of like standing there having drunk 3 gallons of Diet Coke and trying to summon up the courage to get on the dance floor was terrifying.
Yeah.
Flying is a bad one.
Mm.
You know, if you're frightened of flying and you've relied on a drink to get on an aeroplane, suddenly you don't have that.
It's a big one for people, that one, isn't it? Mm. People often talk about that in sessions.
No rescue remedy for us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I'm just thinking about, you know, what's really important to us is that while, you know, people listen to this, it's just looking for, you know, I'm quoting somewhere else, but the sort of similarities and not the kind of differences. You know, I'm sure we're going to provoke things in people. There isn't one type of alcoholic or addict. There isn't one type of recovery, as you say. There's lots of different. But I think what we're trying to get to, aren't we, is just saying, can we reach out? You know, in another episode, we're going to talk about where to go for help. And I know this is a passionate thing for you, is it's not all fee-paying. Some of it's free. Yeah. You know, we're going to be talking about various self-help groups.
Absolutely.
And we're going to be talking about charities that are still functioning despite cuts. And of course, there are the private places as well.
Mm. But also what I want to reiterate is that we've got some amazing guests coming up on these podcasts. But regardless of their professions and the standing that they have in those professions, nobody is judging anybody else. As you say, we're just a bunch of people who've suffered from the same disease, and we're trying to help each other to open a wider and more honest discussion about something that has affected us all.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed listening to us, please feel free to subscribe. And if you feel inclined to give us a glowing review, you would quite honestly make our day.
You really will.
Thank you so much.